Okay, so I've got many beautiful questions here. I don't know where to start from. If sacrifice beyond a contrite heart is necessary, how would non-Christians or even non-sacramental Christians, for example, Protestants, gain the graces of reparation? It's a good question, right? So yes, obviously the fundamental thing that everyone needs to do after sin is contrition. That's the first and foremost thing. You have to make an act of contrition. And without sacramental confession, you need to make an act of perfect contrition. And perfect contrition, we know, is to be sorry for sin first and foremost because it offends God, who's all good and and loves us. And imperfect contrition is to be sorry for sin because it means that we'll go to hell because of punishment. That's good too, right? We want both, because it's very reasonable to be sorry for sin because we're going to go to hell. That's eminently reasonable. But we want to have perfect contrition by which we also are sorry above all because it offends God, who loves us. Okay, so that's necessary for all people at all time. And so the question is, what do people do who are outside the Christian economy of outside the church, outside the Catholic Church, what sacrifice can they offer? And the answer is, it's a little difficult. The sacraments work also by desire. In other words, you can get the effect of a sacrament through rightly desiring that sacrament, even though you can't receive the sacrament. An example of this is baptism. If a catechumen, somebody who wants to enter the Catholic Church, wants to be baptized, if he dies before he is baptized, what happens to him? Well, he is saved through what? Through baptism. Through the desire for baptism. And that desire can be explicit or even implicit. A desire for baptism can be implicit if a person wants to do God's will, no matter what, but he doesn't know that God's will is for him to get baptized, to enter the Catholic Church, and to participate in the Eucharist. He doesn't know that, and therefore he doesn't desire it explicitly because he doesn't know that that's God's will. But as long as he desires to do God's will no matter what, which means to follow conscience and has sorrow for sin, and if he has perfect contrition, he can have the effects of baptism through his desire, right? And we call that the baptism of desire. Now, if that applies to baptism, it's reasonable to think it could apply likewise to the Eucharist in a way. So, for example, if I can't receive the Eucharist on a particular day, I can always make a spiritual communion by which I spiritually ask the Lord to come into my soul, even though I can't receive him sacramentally at that moment. And thus I can receive the effects of communion through my spiritual communion. And that depends on my disposition, how much fervor I have. In fact, it's possible for a person making a spiritual communion with great fervor to receive far more grace than somebody else who receives sacramental communion without fervor. Now, if that's true of communion, it's reasonable to think that it's also true of the sacrifice, even though that's ascending rather than descending mediation. So I can participate in offering the sacrifice of the Mass through my desire to do so. And so, yes, non-Christians, in a sense, they're not separated from Christ's sacrifice, first of all, because he offered it for them. So even though that person can't co-offer it, at least Christ offered it for them. And so they're not without a participation in Christ's sacrifice. So we could say, just in general, that everyone who has contrition for their sins, has perfect contrition, and invincible ignorance of the Catholic Church, they're outside the Church, they're touched by the efficacy of Christ's sacrifice. And of course, the very grace by which they had contrition, where did it come from? Christ's sacrifice. So they're touched by Christ's sacrifice. Christ's sacrifice has a universal effect, even though we do have the power to say no. Right? I have the power to not receive the grace that he offers me through that sacrifice. But nevertheless, all men are given in mysterious ways the capacity to cooperate with that sacrifice. And that's a general principle in theology. We say, God gives sufficient grace to all men to be saved. So if you grew up in China and you've never heard of Christ in the church, still God gives you sufficient grace to be saved. It may be more difficult, but nevertheless, he touches your conscience such that you can start a road to conversion and be saved, every person. And that, of course, comes through what? Through the merits of Christ's sacrifice. So there's a connection with Christ's sacrifice to every person who's touched by God's sufficient grace. And that reaches to everyone. Being inside the church, we have so many more advantages, right? Because we receive the sacraments. We have those ordinary channels. But nevertheless, the sacraments can also touch those who are without. All right? That's it's a beautiful question. I didn't do justice to it. That leads to another question here. And this concerns the royal and common priesthood. In Exodus chapter 19, it says, Moses speaking to Israel, says, you are a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And so God says through Moses to the people of Israel that all of you are a kingdom of priests. In other words, all of Israel, in a sense, had a priestly function. Not only Aaron and his sons. All of Israel participated in the priesthood. Why? Well, because they could spiritually co-offer those sacrifices and are somehow, by being in grace, they can be involved also in descending mediation. In other words, that priesthood is ascending and descending mediation between man and God. Well, Israel was given, as a whole, was given the power to participate that. Not just Aaron and his sons, but also the whole people, because they were a priestly people, because the people offer them spiritually the sacrifices with the priest. Right? So the whole people of Israel was a priestly people. And the whole people of Israel, in a sense, won from God graces for mankind, not just for Israel, but also for the surrounding nations. Well, obviously the same is true in the church. In the church, too, there's a common priesthood as well as a ministerial priesthood. And we know that through the first letter of St. Peter. Chapter 2 says, speaking to the new Israel, the church, St. Peter says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were no people, but now you are God's people. And so Peter has quoted Moses. He's quoted the line for Exodus to show that in the church too, there's a common royal priesthood of all the faithful. And we become priests in that sense through baptism. And what that means is that baptism makes it possible for us to participate in the Eucharist and to co-offer the Eucharist with the priest. Obviously, the common priesthood of the faithful couldn't do it without the ministerial priesthood. If there weren't priests who were ordained, who have holy orders, to offer the Eucharist in the person of Christ, Christ will never become present on the altar, and will never, the people, the baptized faithful, will never be able to co-offer it. So the royal priesthood of the whole Christian people depends on the ministerial priesthood and doesn't replace it, doesn't make it superfluous or unnecessary. In other words, our royal priesthood as baptized faithful depends on their ministerial priesthood and is in harmony with it. And so, yes, and that's a great dignity. All of us have that priestly dignity of being able to co-offer the sacrifice of Christ and to put our own little sacrifices of our life, which seem pretty big at times, to put them on the paten with Christ's sacrifice and to offer that to God. That's our royal priesthood. We can offer, ultimately what it means is that we're to offer our lives. All the events of our lives, our daily lives, our sufferings, our struggles, our joys, our tears, we're to offer them with Christ for the salvation of the whole world. And therefore, there's also a descending mediation that we can win graces from God for our neighbor. And we can do that in many ways, through prayer, through good example, through works of charity, and apostolate, trying to tell people about the truth and to win them to the church, etc., to bring them to greater sanctity. And so we're all called to have that dual priestly mediation, ascending and descending. But again, it's in dependence on the ordained priest who offers it in the person of Christ and who can absolve us from our sins so as to give us the state of grace by which our apostolate will have efficacy. Right, so that's a beautiful, beautiful notion that we're not aware enough about, that common priesthood of the faithful. Vatican II put a great emphasis on the common priesthood in Lumen Gentium and many places to try to help Christians to become aware of this dignity and this mission. Now, one further point that this question points out is that Protestants, Luther made a mistake on this. Luther emphasized rightly the common priesthood of the faithful, but he didn't think there was any distinction. In other words, he thought that the only priesthood in the church was the royal priesthood of the faithful. And thus everyone is a priest, but there's no one who's a ministerial ordained priest. And that makes it impossible for the baptized really to exercise their priestly function, because that priestly function centers on the Eucharist, and we need the ordained priest to offer it. And so the Reformation lost that. They lost the source of the priestly efficacy of all the baptized faithful, because that's rooted in the Eucharist. So the two go intimately together. Yes, it's right to emphasize the common priesthood of the faithful, but not to neglect, not to deny the ministerial priesthood at the same time. So, for example, Lumen Gentium says that there's a difference not just in degree between the common priesthood of the faithful and the ministry. It's not just that they have a little bit more sanctity or something. There's an essential difference between the two, because the ordained priest acts in the person of Christ, and we act as his members. We're the members of Christ. Yes, we're members of his body. But the priest acts as the head, in the person of Christ, the head. And that's why he can take bread and wine and make it the body of Christ. That's why he can absolve sins, because only God can do that. So that's a great question. And the key thing then that this leads to is our responsibility as being recipients of this dignity of being priests, all of us. And so that's none of us live up to it as we should, right? The saints try to live up to it. And so we need to pray that we can be imbued with that spirit. That's a beautiful thing. Okay, here's another question. Do we know what line Mary came from? Maybe somebody can help me on this. I would say probably the line of David, because we know that Joseph came from the line of David. Because the genealogies that are given to us in the Bible, they are the genealogies of Joseph, even though Joseph's not the carnal father of Jesus. But nevertheless, he's the legal father. And in the Jewish mentality, it's the legal paternity, the juridical paternity, that gives the genealogy. So the genealogies give us that of Joseph. And Our Lady? Well, it's reasonable to think that she was of the same tribe, because that's how marriages were done, and of the same line of David, to preserve that. We do also know that she's related to Elizabeth, cousin of Elizabeth, who is the wife of a priest, of therefore the line of Aaron and Levi. And so it's reasonable to think that there's also a Levitical line in Mary. I don't know, can you add to that? Or
I think by the tradition of the church, if I am right, I cannot recall from where, the parents of Mary were Joachim and Anne.
Mm-hmm.
I think the father is from Davidic line and the mother is from Aaron.
Right, that would make perfect sense. Right, that Mary would be from the Davidic line on one side, Joachim, and Levitical on the other, through Anna. Thank you. Okay. Has the new position of the priest in the Novus Ordo Mass, facing the people, obliterated the meaning of the priest as mediator? Okay. This is a little polemic. This could be taken in a controversial sense. Just let me explain. In the traditional celebration of the Mass, of the Latin Rite, up until 1962, the priest and the people faced the same direction. And apparently that was true also in the early patristic times as well, that in the first centuries of the Church, the priest and the people faced the same direction during the Eucharistic sacrifice, and they always faced, in the first century, the east. Everyone faced the east. That was a tradition that all followed, that prayer had to be done facing east, especially the prayer of the Eucharist. And if the Church was oriented west, that meant that everyone had to face the door. So, for example, St. Peter's in Rome, because of the Tapari, it was built on the tomb of St. Peter, it had to be oriented not east but west, just because of the landscape. So what did that mean? That meant that at the Eucharist, everyone turned and faced out the rising sun, because the idea of facing east was to look at the rising sun, which represents Christ who will come in his second coming. Normally, the churches were made such that they were oriented east, so that you face towards the apse, or the crucifix on the apse. And most churches, you can see, are designed precisely that everyone is facing that same way, and all the offering goes up. For example, very often you find these beautiful high altars that the whole attention is centered on them. After the reform of the liturgy by Paul VI, it became customary for the priest to turn around, and the altars were generally made freestanding and often dismantled, etc. That wasn't mandated by the Second Vatican Council. Second Vatican Council didn't say anything about the orientation of the priest. It was something, and it wasn't even in the first missal of Paul VI. In fact, there's no mention made of the orientation, and the impression is given that the priest would be normally facing the altar, meaning facing the same way as the people, and would turn at certain moments. But nevertheless, it became customary for the priest to be facing the people for the last 40 years. Cardinal Ratzinger, when he was cardinal, before he became pope, wrote several books in which he recommended returning to the original orientation. He has a beautiful book, The Spirit of the Liturgy. And the reason that he gives is because it has to do with this mediation that we're talking about, that the priest is leading the people in this offering, which is an offering that's not just his, but also ours. And so it's fitting, symbolically, liturgically, that we be oriented the same way, because we're all offering the sacrifice. He's offering it in the person of Christ. We're offering it in the person of the Church. But nevertheless, we're all offering the same sacrifice, and it's fitting that we all be ordered towards God the Father, who's represented in the East, or, if the Church is not oriented to the East, in the apse or the crucifix. Anyway, that's a fitting thing. I agree with the Pope on that point, that that would be a fitting to return to all be faced the same way. Whether that happens, that depends on the on many other factors, because, that depends on the local bishop, it depends on the priest, it depends on the fact that we've also gotten used to this over 40 years, and anyway. But nevertheless, the point that Ratzinger made, I think, is very excellent. Okay. This is a difficult question. When were the concepts of sacrifice and sin lost in Western civilization? Let's see. I've gone over time, so I can't answer this. But there's a progression. And like everything, it has stages. And one important stage, I would certainly put in the Protestant Reformation, which is in a way paradoxical, because Luther, in one sense, was speaking about sin all the time. He overemphasized sin. Some of his sermons, he says, there's sin. You're born into your sin is your element. You breathe. You say to sin, you are my father. I don't know. He goes on and on about sin, but at the same time, he acts as if we don't have the freedom not to do it. In other words, he really denies free will, and Calvin as well. And therefore, sin, though, has got to be something voluntary. And so if I can't avoid it, if I'm sinning all the time and I can't avoid it, am I really sinning if I can't avoid it, if it's not voluntary? And then further, when he says that salvation by faith alone and not by good works, you can be simultaneously a sinner and justified, again, it leads you to, practically speaking at least, and this was felt right in Germany of his day, all the authors say, Luther himself lamented that sin was just abounding in the Germany of his time, in the Reformation. Because if you say that it doesn't matter for your salvation, as long as you have faith, it makes sin less important, even though a double message is being given. Anyway, that was one stage in the loss of the concept of sin. A more important stage, perhaps, was the Enlightenment, with the idea of natural religion. The thinkers of the Enlightenment didn't deny God, but they thought of God as a clockmaker God who put the world in order and then steps back from it and isn't personally involved in it, isn't a personal God. And thus, the notion of offending a God who loves us tended to vanish. How can you offend a clockmaker God or a law of nature or an impersonal God? And so sin loses all meaning if God isn't a God who loves me. Yeah. So the Enlightenment really did much more, carried further. And then, obviously, atheism does the finishing stroke. If there is no God at all, well, sin simply makes no sense. Because sin is precisely, first and foremost, an offense against God's law. And if there's no God who makes a moral law, there can be no such thing as sin. And so the end result is that... But the funny thing is, though, of course, well, it's not the funny, the terrible thing is that we've got conscience, even though we deny God. And so our conscience still touches us. You're in a much worse state, because you still do have guilt. You still know in your heart that you've offended that moral law, and there's no one from whom to seek forgiveness. Right? This is the greatest of all calamities. Right? And that's what affects so many of our contemporaries. Right? It leads to despair. And our time really is not marked by hope, but by despair outside the church. Inside the church, I hope it's marked by hope, but outside, it's marked by despair. That was the way of the pagan nations before Christ, and so it's becoming more the tone of our current civilization. Yeah. One last question here. This is simpler. Why couldn't the Jews could rebuild the temple when they were exiled to Babylon and the first temple was destroyed? When they came back from Babylon, they built a second temple. But then, when it was destroyed in 70 AD, how come they couldn't rebuild it? That's a very good question, and it's first and foremost because of circumstances. It was never possible to rebuild it. First, because the Roman Empire wouldn't let them. They put a pagan temple on the site of the Temple of Solomon. And then Julian tried, but failed, and then the mosque got put there. And then the second reason, I think, is because, and there's a difference of opinion here, some Hasidic Jews, some Orthodox Jews, would rebuild the temple if they could. Others think that the Messiah has to come first, or there has to be a divine order to reestablish it. And that makes sense, because when the temple was rebuilt after the exile, the prophets received the word that the temple was supposed to be rebuilt. The prophets after the exile. And in fact, they reproved the people. They say, you've come back to Jerusalem and you're living in houses, but the Lord doesn't yet have a house. And you wonder why he's not blessing your harvest, etc. Build first the house of the Lord and then you'll receive these blessings. So they were commanded to rebuild it, but no such command was received after the destruction of the second temple. And we can understand why, right? Because there's a new priesthood and a new sacrifice, which is the Eucharist. So, and now I have to let you go home. So thank you so much.